You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On Mysteries and Monsters today, my guest is Tobias Wayland from the Singular Fortean Society. Tobias's latest book, Strange Tales of the Impossible, is a collection of reports, incidents and witness interviews collated through his work alongside his wife Emily and the Singular Fortean Society. From cryptids and moments of lost time, a UFO encounter that ended up being featured as part of Project Blue Book, smartly dressed ghosts, terrifying flying creatures, and a picnic that gets really weird, Tobias brings us a collection of weird incidents from the world of high strangeness. We discuss this and many other aspects of his work on this week's show. As always, before that, don't forget, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for Patreon. You can find the link in our show notes, or simply go to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters to sign up for $4 a month for ad-free episodes, early releases, and bonus content. And a big welcome to Mary Francis, my latest Patreon. Thank you for your support. You can also find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find us at mysteriesandmonsters.com, where you'll be able to get your Mysteries and Monsters merchandise if you wish. As always, a big thank you to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork on this week's show, and the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Mysteries and Monsters is also delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. So, hold on to your hats as we go in search of some strange tales of the impossible with Tobias Wayland. On this week's show, I am delighted to welcome Tobias Wayland back to Mysteries and Monsters. The head writer and editor for the Singular Fortean Society, Tobias's years as an investigator have served him best by illustrating when it comes to the mysterious and strange. Any answers he's found are still hopelessly outnumbered by the questions they raise. Tobias, welcome back, sir.
Paul, thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. I can't believe it's been nearly 2 years. It seems like only yesterday. It's one of those things. I think the last 2 years are just a blur for us all now.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we can't even count 2020. You know, nobody got much done that year. So really, it's been more like 1 year if you take that into consideration.
Yeah, one year in cat years, perhaps we should call it. So, everything going on with you, obviously, even despite all the challenges that we've faced around the world, the strange and the weird have continued to appear wherever. And your latest book is a eclectic collection of encounters and witness statements and interviews that yourself and Emily have been involved with, along with other contacts such as Lon Strickler and our good friend Adam over at the Pine Barrens. When you came to pull Strange Tales of the Impossible together, Tobias, I suppose one of the best ways to describe it's a collection of unusual phenomena rather than focusing on one particular strand of the Fortean, is it not?
Yeah, I would say that is largely accurate. What I had seen developing over the past few years, as we never particularly specialized in any one area of the paranormal, we would get a variety of stories, you know, presented to us by witnesses. And it wasn't as though they didn't have anything in common. Certainly they had a lot in common, but the issue was that they didn't have the sort of main paranormal genre in common, you know. So we would get tales of ghosts and hauntings from people and folks who had experienced alien abduction or some other kind of weird nighttime visitation or a cryptid sighting or something similar. And across all of those seemingly disparate phenomena, there were these common threads. And so when it came time to sort of collect them together, to be presented, you know, I couldn't fathom writing just a UFO book or just a cryptid book, because fundamentally it felt to me as though what was really important about these phenomena wasn't the surface level judgments that we make about them, but rather the actual core of the experience itself, which seems very, very similar across all phenomena with all witnesses.
Yeah, very much so. And I suppose it's easy often for people to try and pigeonhole various experiences into one kind of phenomena or paranormal encounter, as it is, Tobias. But I think one of the things that struck me about this book is that there is a real kind of fluctuation between some of these encounters that you've covered in this, and I think that's what gives this book a real depth of interest, because it's not just, as you refer to there, it's not just a book about winged humanoids, it's not just a book about creatures or strange cryptids or ghosts. It's a lovely mixture of them, and I think that's what keeps you turning the pages, because you never know what the next chapter is going to focus on.
Yeah, it really does go all over the place in terms of the types of phenomena. But, you know, like I said, it's so difficult to categorize this stuff so often. You know, I mean, you could look at, say, something like shadow people. I mean, shadow people as a phenomenon largely act as a sort of paranormal cipher, right? Like they basically end up being whatever people want them to be. Narratively, you know, in terms of whatever you know, sort of box they're trying to put this experience into. You know, I remember, you know, speaking with a woman up in this was in Rogers, Minnesota, and she telling me about this experience she and her family had had with shadow people, as it often does, as her telling me about this singular experience with a shadow person. And of course, through a questioning her during our interview, that led to her telling me about multiple sightings of shadow people within their home, people seeing strange orbs of light. And I don't mean like, you know, dust, a digital camera or something. I mean, seeing these orbs with their naked eye, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could look at this experience, you know, and if you were particularly interested in ghosts and hauntings, you'd say, oh, well, their house is haunted. If you were particularly interested in something like alien abduction, you would look at the interaction of these entities, or seemingly the interaction of these entities with her grandson, who appeared to be watched by them. And you would say, oh, well, this is some sort of like alien abduction scenario where he's being taken or something. But the reality is we don't know that it's any of those. All we know is the experiential, you know, aspect of this case, which is these people have claimed to see these shadowy entities, and we really have no clue based on their behavior, what exactly it is that they want. But like I said, you can fit them into almost any narrative that you like. And you see that quite a bit across all paranormal disciplines, where one person's glowing orb is one person's UFO and another person's ghost light, right? and fundamentally, we just don't have any idea what any of them actually are. All we really have to go on is the experiential evidence provided by these witnesses and whatever we can glean from that.
Yeah. Do you find it difficult sometimes, Tobias, when yourself and Emily are interviewing these people, that, as you refer to there, sometimes people will try and decide what they've experienced, if they're into ufology or they believe it's shadow people or they believe their house is haunted? Whatever's happened, they will try and fit their experience to that. And it's, I would imagine it's quite difficult when you're dealing with these reports sometimes, that you have to try and unpick it and go back to the actual phenomenon rather than the person's explanation or way that they've tried to make peace with what they've experienced.
Oh, yes. I mean, that is a large percentage of what I do as an investigator, you know, and that's where that English degree comes in really handy, is quite honestly, you know, is in being able to separate story from narrative, you know, to sort of identify the aspect of a report that are subjective and try to get as close to the objective reality of the person's experience as possible. Because yes, that does happen quite often. People will have their own personal biases, you know, towards what they think has happened to them. And I don't say that to sound arrogant or condescending. Mm-hmm. I think that that's perfectly reasonable. Something that a lot of people struggle with, quite understandably, is trying to make sense of their experience. And that can be very, very difficult for them to do. And so what they will try to do, of course, is do their own quote unquote research. That often involves a lot of Googling, and they'll come across a lot of untested hypotheses and unproven theories online, and they will use them to try to inform their own experience. And so you just have the proliferation of information, unfortunately. One thing I have found, though, is most people are reasonable. And so if I am speaking with a witness and they really are interested in trying to understand their experience better, it can be relatively easy to absolve them of any unproven theories or anything that might be coloring, you know, their perception of their personal experience. And so I think one of the best things that we do actually is being able to work with these witnesses and not provide them with, you know, false hope or misinformation that might make them feel better or sometimes worse, but, you know, rather really try to help them understand. I hesitate to use the word reality because we don't really have much of an idea necessarily what exactly is happening, but really try to help them understand, I think, as well as we can or as close as we can, the sort of objectivity of their experience, you know, in that, okay, well, I believe you that this thing happened, and it could mean any number of things. And here's what those things are potentially, and here's what is much less likely. And people, I think, respond to that because fundamentally, I think that we need to give people more credit. I think witnesses deserve more credit than sometimes they're given when we speak about them, you know, just sort of abstractly.
Yeah.
And they're relatively smart, and they know when things make sense and when they don't make sense. And when all they have to cling to is something that they know doesn't necessarily make the most sense, but it's all they've been presented with, I think it leads to a certain amount of cognitive dissonance that can be very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
When we can sort of help them and provide them a sort of clearer level of critical thinking about these phenomena, which is something that is sorely lacking in this field much of the time, I think that gives them a sense of comfort because it gives them a sense of control, you know, where they can say now, okay, I can actually examine this and I can examine it rationally and try to actually understand it instead of, you know, just having, you know, somebody's scary theory online to try to make sense of it.
Yes, very true. It is strange how certain ideas or unproven theories or explanations seem to proliferate through certain fields in the Fortean phenomena, as I'm sure you're very aware of. But as you refer to there about the respect and ability to sort of unpack what witnesses are saying to you and treat them in a fair and balanced manner, one of the first stories and experiences that you cover in the book is with a young lady called Quinn. And I noticed that in your chapter where you're speaking with her, Tobias, you mentioned that she's a very well put together young lady. She's very clever. She's switched on. She's not someone that's prone to flights of fancy. And it's a very interesting encounter because I'm always a sucker for a good ghost story. But this one is especially intriguing, because we have a smartly dressed spirit, it would seem, that appears infrequently. But the thing that's also struck me about this is the two things about the experience that Quinn refers to is that it's very clear she can see what this spirit is wearing, but it's also very clear that she can't see its face whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, it's it was a fascinating case, and Quinn is absolutely is not the kind of person you would expect to have a series of experiences like this, you know, let alone be willing to speak about them with us. And so it was interesting in interviewing her, you know, to sort of find out that this is something that had actually had a major impact on her since childhood, frankly. And it was something that she had very much turned away from. And I think had reached a certain point in her life where she realized that she couldn't necessarily ignore that it had happened, and sort of had to make her peace with this as a significant portion of her identity. You know, there was just really no ignoring it. And the phenomena themselves were interesting, you know, certainly. And they all very much thematically sort of fit with that traditional idea of something like a haunted house, you know. So she would talk about, you know, seeing these sort of apparitions or hearing footsteps or waking up to a ball bouncing in a room or something, which is straight out of a horror movie. And I think the culmination of that or perhaps like the most powerful experiences involve that figure that you mentioned specifically, this sort of faceless tuxedo man. And what was interesting about that is, you know, as you mentioned, the clothing of this apparition was very, very clear. She could make out this tuxedo. She could make out the tuxedo well enough that she could find pictures of it and be like, that's the tuxedo. Mm. But the rest of the features of this thing, this entity, were nondescript. You know, it was like a swirling gray mist or something similar. And what's perhaps most interesting to me, actually, in looking at Quinn's experiences is that they fit this sort of model of nighttime visitation. Now, there are certain things that her experiences had in common with so many other paranormal experiences, you know, sort of cross-genre, that I couldn't ignore them. You know, like one of them specifically is the idea of the sort of bedroom visitation, right? So, you know, she talks about, I think it might have been her actual literal last experience in the house because she wouldn't stay in there after this.
Yes.
Wake up to hear her neighbor's dog barking and then, or being woken up, you know, ostensibly by her neighbor's dog barking and then seeing this figure standing by her bed, sort of leaning over, looking at her, and it's this tuxedo man, and the tuxedo is there, and it's clear and sharp, and then the rest of the body, where you would expect, you know, the human proportions to be, was all, you know, this swirling gray smoke. And now that is something that you will hear people describe, you know, not just in instances of ghosts and hauntings. Like you'll hear that, you know, with say the shadow person or shadow people encounters at Minnesota House that I was talking about before. Mm. You know, that was an instance where people had woken up to see a shadowy figure, just you know, a black silhouette of something humanoid, watching them sleep. I myself, I mentioned it in the book, have had the experience of waking up to a shadowy figure next to me while I sleep. What's interesting about that too is, and I didn't mention this because I didn't know if you would be okay with it, but I'll go ahead and say it on this podcast because I'm sure he won't listen to it. My brother, years after my experience, we were at a wedding in Ohio. And, you know, as people in their early 20s will do, you know, we were sort of drinking at the reception, and it ended kind of early, and we were all staying at a hotel because we were from out of town, and so we decided that we would go hit up this bar nearby.
Mm-hmm.
We went and got some drinks, and we were sort of just talking like brothers do, and he had no idea about my experience. But we had had enough to drink at a certain point where I was like, hey man, have you ever experienced anything weird in mom and dad's house? And he was, he kind of thought about it for a second, and he was like, well, there was this one time where I woke up and there was this shadowy figure standing next to my bed. But, he was like, I was just assumed that I must have been seeing things, and so I rolled over and I went back to sleep. And sort of the way he described it, was was exactly like my experience. But you hear about similar things in like alien abduction experiences, so on and so forth. There is this recurring theme throughout the paranormal. People will talk about waking up, to see a Bigfoot staring in their window at them or something. This reoccurring theme exists of people being visited while they're at their most vulnerable. Often these cases take place at night, even if somebody isn't in bed. It is still often at night, if they're relaxing or even just like, say, out running an errand or something. So much about this seems accidental on sort of our end, but as though there is this sense of purpose in the phenomenon itself. And like I said, you just see these themes over and over again, nighttime visitation or bedroom visitation. And they're just so similar. And that was something that really stuck out to me with Quinn's experience when she talked about, especially that occasion where the tuxedo man showed up while she was sleeping like that.
And it is interesting. What strikes me about Quinn's experiences is that it seems to be a developing phenomenon as well, because obviously the first time she sees it, she presumes at first that it's just a reflection, and realizes she shuts her eyes several times and puts her heads under the covers and keeps coming back, and the image is still there, Tobias. So it's very interesting that it seems to have gone from just appearing in a mirror to then sort of, I would imagine it would have felt like it was leaning over her and leering into her.
Yeah, it certainly seems like there was an element of observation. I mean, I can't think of a better way to put it that doesn't impose some narrative bias. Mm. Because I'm not comfortable assuming, in emotional state for this entity or a particular motivation without more evidence. But I think it's very fair to say that it appeared to be looking at her. At least its posture was similar to what you would expect if somebody was sort of leaning over looking at her. So it just really, really is strange. There is this sort of theme of observation that we see over and over and over again as well. Again, like across all phenomena, where people essentially report these experiences that seem more than anything like they're just being observed for whatever reason.
It strikes me when we speak with people, or we hear from people who've had these experiences, regardless of the phenomena involved, it is weird how people seem to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, or wake up at the wrong time, it would seem, to encounter something. And one of the other witnesses that you speak with, a lady called Bette Dodson, is one of those where she's just driving to her sister's. She could have set off 5 minutes earlier or 5 minutes later. Would the encounter still have occurred? Because as far as she's concerned, she's just having a leisurely drive to her sister's. It normally takes her 20 minutes, and she unfortunately encounters quite a terrifying creature of some description. And it's a very odd aspect of all this, is that it's always strikes me as how thin the line is between having these kind of experiences, Tobias, or just, if you'd have gone past 30 seconds later, would she have still encountered this strange creature?
Well, there is in element of randomness, I think in many experiences, especially when somebody just seems to be, you know, going out about their business. When it comes to Beth, though, I will say her experiences again started in the realm of nighttime and bedroom visitation, because she talks about when she was just 13 years old, you know, which would have been at least 5 years before the winged humanoid incident. She's 13 and she wakes up in the very early morning, something like 2 a.m., to this bright light flooding her room. And her thought is that the mountain near their house is on fire. You know, that's how bright it is. Mm. And she looks out and she sees this cigar-shaped craft that she said was shining these twin beams of light around, and she's just paralyzed at the sight of this thing. And then she says afterward she suffered these odd symptoms of sort of shock and fatigue, and she was running a fever. And it wasn't long after that that she said this. You know, this was another really even more, I think, exaggerated experience, you know, showing the theme of observation. But she was in bed reading her book. You know, she's reading casually. Most of us have probably been there. And she sees this shadowy figure with this weird bird face and a strange grin peering at her through the doorway of her bedroom. And then it was after that, like after both of those experiences, when she was 18, that she had the encounter while driving to her sister's house. So for anybody not familiar with that experience, so essentially, while she was driving to her sister's house, she saw, as she passed the intersection, she sees this strange bird-like winged humanoid in front of her, across the street, sort of up against the side of this barn, and it's illuminated by her headlights, and she's terrified, and so she turns and gets out of it. And this thing takes off after her, and it flies after her. And it more or less attacks her car, you know, seemingly beating it and trying to get at her into it, or get at her in the car. And she blacks out. She doesn't remember anything for hours until she comes to and is driving way off course, you know, miles away from where she should have been. No explanation how she got there. So she has this experience of missing time mid-encounter, where she then suddenly comes to and she's driving still. I marvel at that, frankly, because I think I don't know what it can tell us necessarily about these phenomena or this phenomenon specifically, but it should be very disturbing to anyone hearing it, assuming of course that is authentically relating her experience. But having spoken to her directly, I don't have any reason to suspect that she isn't, because the idea of blacking out and having no conscious recollection of anything that's happened to you, and then suddenly to sort of regain consciousness while driving, while still driving your motor vehicle is terrifying, frankly. You know, she's lucky that she didn't end up dead in a ditch.
Mm.
Very easy for her to lose control during that experience. But specifically because she had had the two prior experiences, and one of them directly was sort of a similar entity. I would argue in Beth's case, assuming that, you know, there is some sort of a phenomenon in interacting with her, that it was very purposeful in its interception of her, you know, during that experience in her car. I don't know why. I can only speculate why, but it doesn't seem to be as random as other people who really haven't had any prior experiences or contact or anything, who just, you know, sort of see something while they're out and about running errands or something similar.
Yeah, I often find that remarkable, as you say, when people are suddenly aware that they can't remember how they've got there and they're driving a car. I mean, Bette's journey, I think, in her retelling of it, normally would have taken her 20 minutes, Tobias, and she's found herself, I think she says, nearly 4 hours later, you know, nowhere near where she should be. So to all intents and purposes, we've got a strange encounter, we've got missing time, we've got a lack of recall, and we've ended up in an unusual place that has no relevance to the journey that she was attempting to make. And as you say there, the fact that she's managed to get through all that without serious injury is another one of those aspects of things like this that I think we often overlook, that despite the strangeness of the encounter, there often does seem to be a kind of caring attitude that these people are still returned, if we can say such a term, because we don't know where they've been, we don't know if they have been anywhere. But it is peculiar that often people just sort of come round driving as if it's like nothing's happened.
It is. You know, I think that, you know, without assuming too much, you make a really good point in that there does seem to be an element of care present in these experiences. You know, people often ask me if I am frightened by the things that I have experienced in my life, you know, these seemingly paranormal encounters, and I tell them no. If I was gonna be hurt, I'd be hurt by now. You know, if they wanted to hurt me, whatever they are, they could at any time, and they've certainly had ample opportunity. And I have to believe if that was the goal, I would already be hurt. You know, so I think it's normal to still be startled. That's just a reflex. There isn't much we can do about that, but. In terms of actually being frightened, I don't think people have much to fear. You know, of course, people like to bring up missing persons in state parks and things like that. I personally, before jumping to the conclusion that there is, you know, necessarily some malevolent paranormal consciousness or entity or something behind that, would like to see a little more evidence. But personally, in the cases that I've investigated and the witnesses with whom I've spoken, certainly none of them have ever been physically harmed. I would assume that that's on purpose because, you know, I don't know that without some kind of external intervention that Bette would have been able to suddenly resume. Well, really, to retain her ability to drive while seemingly unconscious, that seems strange enough. You know, like, was she really guiding, or was something else taking care of it for her until such time as they were done doing whatever it was they were doing, and then she regained consciousness.
And I think the other aspect of some of these witnesses that you speak with and the stories that you bring forward in the book, Tobias, is it must be hard for somebody, especially Bette is a prime example of one of the encounters that you cover, where you have to kind of say to yourself, or I would certainly look at it in an aspect of, how has that person held that in and been able to deal with this? Because I would imagine that people like Bette don't have friends like us, Tobias, who you can open up to and be honest and expect a sympathetic ear and a conversation to come out of it. You know, you're not going to be dismissed out of hand or told that you're hallucinating or you're obviously on some kind of medication or you're not well and you need help. It must be really difficult because obviously Bette's encounter is I think it's 1986. So she'd held that in for the best part of 35 years almost, before actually finding a way to sort of let it out. When you speak with people like Bette, because there are other witnesses that you interview and bring forward their stories in the book, Tobias, that some of these encounters are decades old. Is that something that when you speak with people like this through your work, do these people ever kind of open up about how this encounter's made them feel in regards to having to hold it in for so long?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. No, the most common experience in terms of being able to relate their sighting or the scenario that people most often encounter post sighting is they want to tell somebody, obviously. And so they go to a loved one, could be a close friend or a spouse or a sibling, parent, whatever. And they will tell them. And this person that normally they would hope to be able to trust with any situation, as often as not, laughs at them. And that's very, very difficult. And so most people just kind of shut up about it after that. And you've got these witnesses sort of leading lives of quiet desperation with no one they feel comfortable talking with regarding these sightings until they find someone like us. And then they finally have someone that they feel comfortable, you know, who isn't going to judge them for their experience or mock them or try to explain in a way in a way that frankly is contradictory to all sense if you are taking the witness seriously, which I very much think that we should. And so, you know, yeah, it's very, very difficult. And frankly, that again is one of the main reasons that we do what we do. You know, I certainly didn't always have people that I could talk about stuff like this in my own life, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, up until I met Emily and we started the Singular Freudian Society, I didn't have any friends who were into this kind of stuff. That was part of the reason, you know, like there are several core reasons why we started the Singular Freudian Society, and they all center around the witness experience, my own experience, and other people's. You know, I remember when I was a little kid and I began experiencing things that I couldn't explain. This is pre-internet, of course. This would have been, you know, the 80s and then the 90s. And, my only recourse really was to go to the library. I'd ride my bicycle to the local library and I would find weird books, you know? And so I would be reading books by like Brad Steiger and John Keel and Whitley Strieber and all of these people. And they would be talking about people who had experienced things very similar to me. And I took great comfort in that. And it helped. It really did. Even though I didn't know these people, it helped me to know that there were other people experiencing similar things out there. And so I was sort of deliberating over what I wanted to do professionally in terms of my contribution to the paranormal field. That was something that was very much in the forefront of my mind. If the way that I would be able to help witnesses directly in a way that I had never experienced personally, while also helping people indirectly, you know, through writing about these subjects and maybe reaching a wider audience of people that way, then that's something that I thought held a lot of value. And it's because of the experiences of these witnesses. So yeah, you're not wrong. It's a very isolating experience to have when people can't even, you know, speak to their own families about these experiences.
Yeah, I think the cathartic aspect of all this, Tobias, is often a very underrated part of it. And I think allowing people these channels these days and the fact that we seem to be in a more open-minded society in regards to Fortean subjects and the paranormal and other aspects of it, I think helps people like Bette to be able to come to peace with it themselves, like you say, because it must be very difficult. And as you refer to, we've all had situations in our own lives with strange things going on that my social circle outside of the show does not revolve around in-depth conversations about Bigfoot, as much as I'd like it, Tobias. Unfortunately, it's right. it's not a prime choice of conversation when I go to the pub with my friends, sadly. But one of the cathartic things about doing this is that the aspects of being able to speak with people and others around the world about subjects like this. And it helps me, because obviously when you've got a deep interest in that, I think it helps people in general to be able to converse and ruminate over these situations and witnesses and encounters, and allow us to kind of realize that we aren't alone and we do have shared interests regardless of where we come from.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's important for people to be able to have that, and not just for experiencers. You know, I think just for anybody who deals with any level of social isolation based off of their curiosity. There are lots of people involved in this field who started out with a healthy a curiosity and an open mind, and I think that they also feel that sense of isolation, because more often than not, you know, they're likely in the same position as us, where their immediate circle doesn't show a lot of interest, we'll say, in these kinds of subjects. I think on some level I'm just something of a curiosity to a lot of my friends, you know. Like, they'll see something, you know, and they'll be like, "Oh yeah, did you see this thing about Mothman? That's what you do, right?" And I'm just like, "Yeah, I guess. We don't have to talk about it. It's fine."
Yeah, in my normal day job, Tobias, people are often sent over to me and saying, "Oh, speak to Paul. He knows about all these weird things." So yeah, I feel you, Tobias. I mean, one of the other great aspects of this, and we were laughing before we started the conversation proper, was that often when you speak to someone or someone comes forward with an experience, as our next gentleman is here's a chap that comes forward with an encounter or a witness to a strange flying creature, once again, following on from Bette's encounter. And as you refer to, when you speak with people like this, it's always good to ask them, well, has anything else occurred strange in your life? And I found Gerald's story, it made me laugh, Tobias, because it's one of those where the initial report is very interesting. It's deeply fascinating. But the secondary aspect to this and his other encounter, I find probably more remarkable, primarily because he ended up being quoted in Project Blue Book. So we have an official record of this chap's original encounter, which I would imagine gives his whole story, regardless of the two different phenomena he's talking about, it gives it a lot more credence, because he's clearly, once again, a man that felt so strongly about something that happened to him 60 years ago that he came forward with it.
Yeah, I mean, this was something that Gerald had sat on for decades. And, you know, literally it was something that he had said he just wanted to, he wanted to get it off his chest before he died, frankly, you know, just before the end of his life. And imagining, you know, him sitting on this for so long and not being able to share it with anyone. Honestly, the reason that he even came to me with his winged humanoid sighting in the first place was because he had seen one of my other articles, you know, on a similar sighting. And prior to that, he had no idea that anyone anywhere had ever seen anything similar. And I think that's something that anyone interested in these subjects needs to keep in mind. You know, like, we might have heard of Mothman. We might be familiar with the Point Plus sightings and now the things people are reporting in the Midwest around the Great Lakes and everything else. Nobody else is. Like, nobody knows anything about this. Nobody knows what a Mothman is. Nobody's heard of John Keel. Nobody has heard of anybody who's done any work on it ever that we're familiar with. And so you get people like Gerald, and they just have no idea. They have literally no idea that anybody else has ever seen anything similar to what they've seen. And it's so far outside of their experience that they feel like they can't talk about it. Maybe they've had the experience where they tried to and were shot down, and so they just shut up about it forever. But just as often as not, it's so unusual that they just assume that nobody has ever seen anything like it. And if they do talk about it, folks are going to assume that they're crazy, that they've just lost their mind. And that was very much the case with him, you know. And his initial winged humanoid sighting, it wasn't spectacular in terms of high strangeness or anything. He was out hunting, and he saw what he described as this winged creature that had the body of a large man, and he noticed that it had other, you know, humanoid features like these humanoid legs, and said it was covered head to toe in these dark tan colored feathers, and I think it had landed in a tree nearby or something. I'd have to go back and look at it, but it wasn't a very long encounter. It didn't exhibit a lot of the, you know, high strangeness that we've come to associate with winged humanoid sightings. I mean, it was a weird enough sighting. I mean, to see a human bird person out flying while you're walking through a field hunting that's weird enough. I'm not saying it's not. But it was a story that, you know, didn't necessarily seem to speak to a history of experiences or anything. But I asked anyway, something that I ask every witness, and that is, have you either before, during, or since this encounter experienced anything that you would describe as paranormal or unusual in any way? And often when I'm asking that, it is to try to sort of tease out other details that either they have forgotten or sometimes don't think are relevant. You know, not to digress, but I remember speaking with a woman in Maryland who had a winged humanoid encounter. And, you know, I asked her that same question, and she ended up telling me about these psychic experiences that her son had after this encounter, and about how they had this radio that suddenly, after they had this sighting, started turning itself on. And if I hadn't have asked, she would not have associated these things with that sighting, and I wouldn't know. And that was the case with Gerald as well, who told me about some years later, because he had his initial sighting, he was a teenager, and then later he was in the Army, still a young man, and he was on guard duty at a radar station. This would have been at a Nike Hercules missile site in Northfield, Illinois, in 1963. Of the winged humanoid was in 57, and so he still would have been of a fairly young man, and he's standing guard, and he sees this, for lack of a better term, UFO. And of course, I am a traditionalist, and when I say UFO, I mean unidentified flying object. I don't like that people use the term UFO synonymously with extraterrestrial spacecraft. I think that is inaccurate. And so, yeah, he had seen this UFO, saucer-shaped craft with these rotating lights that he said were sort of illuminating what he took to be windows. And so he sees this thing flying. He has to alert his commanding officer because it's kind of a big deal, especially at this Nike Hercules missile site. If there's any unusual aircraft, that's kind of a big deal, and he let somebody know, and so he did. And you know, he didn't think much was gonna come of it until he got a phone call. I think this was several days later. And he was woken up by the phone ringing. And a man, after he answered it, a man on the other end identified himself as Dr. J. Allen Hynek, which I think people familiar with ufology will know was the lead scientist for Project Blue Book. Of course, went on to have a prolific career in ufology following that. But this guy who identified himself as Dr. Hynek basically said that he was told to tell Gerald that what he had witnessed was a small private airplane flying in that area. And so, right, and that phrasing was so interesting to me because it wasn't, he didn't call up and say what you saw was a small private airplane. He called up and said, I was told to tell you that what you saw was a small private airplane. And so assuming that it really was Dr. Hynek, I think that that could have been his way of saying, well, this is, Project Blue Book is largely BS, and they explain things away, because it was. I mean, it was just the whole purpose of it was to explain things away rather than actually explaining them.
Yep.
And so, that could have been his way to say, like, and I don't know what you really saw, but officially you saw an airplane. So great. It was a very interesting story. And the fact is, like, you can look at the public records because they're all public now at this point for Project Blue Book and see that yes, this was actually investigated by, well, quote unquote, investigated by Project Blue Book, and that was the official conclusion that was put in their files was that it was a misidentified aircraft. But that certainly doesn't fit with Gerald's eyewitness experience. And it's just it's a fascinating narrative to me in terms of sort of dancing around the conspiratorial aspect of Project Blue Book, sort of the cover-up aspect of that particular project. And so yeah, I mean I think it's a really valuable experience, and I wouldn't know about it if I wouldn't have asked Gerald, if he'd had any other experiences. Which I can say, if anybody's listening to this and you ever say, hey, I've got this experience that I want to tell Tobias over at the Singular Fortean Society about, and you also have other experiences, yes, I do want to hear about those too. Like, don't assume that I don't, because I really, really do,
The other aspect of Gerald's encounter that made me chuckle as well is that when this alleged, I mean, this is the other thing. I mean, he's not sure it even was Hynek, and as you refer to, the phrasing is very odd, and it's a bit strange that he's basically, I've been told to tell you this is what happened. Is that Gerald was actually a radar operator, so he was very well, he knew what things were in the sky. He knew what things looked like. It was his job. So he just didn't take this at all because clearly his job had trained him to understand and appreciate and identify anything that would be flying over this particular missile site, Tobias. So he knew for a fact that it wasn't a plane. And obviously the way he describes it leaving, clearly it wasn't a plane.
Yeah, I mean that is exactly right. It certainly couldn't have been what the official explanation was. And of course, like I mentioned, we have to we can only assume that it actually was Dr. Hynek, and we have no way of actually knowing. We really don't. Like we can assume that, but we have literally no way of knowing if maybe it was just somebody saying that they were, which would be even weirder, frankly,
Yes.
because it clearly was actually investigated by Blue Book. Like it's in their records, And so why would they have someone call up and impersonate that Dr. Hynek unless, you know, maybe he knew that that was BS and he was completely this is speculation.
Yeah.
You know, unless he knew that that explanation was BS and just kind of refused to tell this guy about it. But at the same time, they didn't need to pretend to be him. They could have just, you know, could have called up and, you know, said like, hey, I'm Corporal, like, what's his name? And this is what we've decided you saw. You know, like they didn't, it would just be so weird to do that. And I don't know why they would, but I, you know, when it comes to the U.S. government, I shouldn't be surprised by anything.
Yeah, very true. Very true. We can try and explain and understand why they do certain things, but I think we'd all be wasting our time, Tobias.
That's very true. Yeah.
One of the other interesting aspects of strange encounters I often find, as odd often as people seeing strange things, Tobias, is people creating in their own minds an explanation that doesn't make sense. And one of the other weird stories that you have is entitled The Strangest Dog You Ever Saw. And what I find interesting about this is often when we deal with strange phenomena and weird encounters, I'm always struck by people who create an explanation that often doesn't sit anywhere near the right thing. And obviously this one is a couple that see something strange, and the lady's husband just basically said, well, isn't that a weird looking dog? Yet everything she's describing about this whole encounter is, as far as she's concerned, it's some kind of weird cat. But then it gets even weirder. And we have this kind of... She refers to the situation as though it seems to be pixelating and going fuzzy, as though the image keeps kind of dropping in and out of her scope of vision or reality even. And it's a very odd aspect, both parts of it, both the encounter and the fact that in her husband's mind, he's decided whatever they've seen, it's a really weird looking dog.
No, I mean, that's all very true. It was such a bizarre encounter. You know, I spoke to this lady, and of course, Emily and I went out to the sighting area, although we didn't, you know, see any weird chimera creatures or anything. But as she's trying to explain what she had seen, you know, she really couldn't nail it down to any particular animal. You know, she's sort of telling us about how some of it looked like it could belong to different animals. Like maybe it was more dog-like, maybe it was more cat-like. She wasn't really sure. And the harder that she looked at it, the more difficulty she had seeing it. Which is bizarre. That's a very strange thing to have happen. If it was a mundane animal, she would have just been able to look at it and be like, oh, look at that, you know, mountain lion or Rottweiler or whatever it was. And so there's definitely aspects of high strangeness in this encounter, you know, above and beyond what you often see in reported cryptid sightings. And her husband's reaction, like I got the impression, you know, really based off of speaking with her about it, that it's not as though he looked over and saw a dog. It was more that he decided it was a dog because that's what he needed to believe after that experience. So he was unable to come to terms with the idea that he was seeing something outside of his reality, or his, you know, his perceived bias of reality. And so he landed on this explanation, and it was the one that let him sleep at night. And so that's the one that he went with. And you do see that. Now, I don't get witnesses saying that to me directly very often, because those aren't the kind of people who actually ever come forward and have their encounters investigated. So, for instance, had he been by himself, we would never have heard of this ever. It never would have come out. I think that the reason that, you know, the people with whom I speak, you know, tend more towards the you know open-minded explanations and such is likely because that's the only kind of people who ever come forward and talk about these sightings. You know, obviously her husband was not forthcoming, and generally, according to her, he's just not willing to speak about it. So I guess it's a good thing she was there, or we never would have heard of it.
Yeah. I mean, there are other aspects of this that are odd as well, that the fact that they see this strange creature and they think, oh, well, that's a bit odd. And they're so struck by what they've seen that they turn the car around and come back and it's still there. And then added to that, that we have a mysteriously seen creature that decides to hang around for a second viewing, which is odd in itself often. We also have the aspect of that they seem to be in some kind of time pocket where they're parked on a main road and they're stood there for, I think they say, 4 or 5 minutes watching this weird creature, and it gets quite close to them, whatever it is. And yet no other traffic comes past at all during this period, which gives it a strange kind of eerie, out of time kind of situation.
That part does seem odd, you know, in reading the encounter. I will say, having been there, it's not a very urban area. You know, like this particular area, you know, it's got fields on either side. There are some houses in this area, but it is fairly rural. And so do I think that it is humanly possible that they were able to sit there without much noticeable traffic for a few minutes? It's technically possible.
Mm.
However, you know, she did note that, you know, at that time of day, it would have been very, very unusual. And so I do think that there might be something to that, you know, like there may be some other aspect of high strangeness occurring, you know, during this encounter that has isolated them, you know. And I don't know. I have to speculate, of course, because I can't really know. But I don't know that it's necessarily that there weren't any cars, you know, rather than the sort of enforced perception that there weren't any cars, you know, because this thing, whatever it was, certainly seemed to be more than capable of skewing perception, you know, just sort of messing with their heads in general. I remember she's talking about it with me, and, you know, like she, again, she talks about how, like, the more she was looking at it, like, the more confused she got, and she got the feeling that this thing, whatever it was very amused by that. Like, it was laughing at her, trying to understand what it was.
Mm.
You know, like, there was this sort of trickster element to it. And so, who knows? Like, maybe, you know, maybe the lack of traffic was some kind of illusion. There's really no way to know, but it certainly seems like whatever explanation, I think, is more in line with some sort of mental manipulation is likeliest to me in this particular scenario.
Yeah, I suppose sometimes you can create a scenario, Tobias, where you think normal situations are stranger than they are because of something else that's happening. I think any of us that have been or lived in a major city or near major thoroughfares will often remark sometimes that on certain times of the day or at certain times of night or whatever, it can seem a bit peculiar that there isn't anywhere near as much traffic as you're used to. And I think maybe sometimes that's because we're programmed in certain situations to expect things to be very busy. And when they're not, because we're so used to it these days, we perceive that to be unusual, where, as you refer to there, it might not be anything odd at all. It's just on top of everything else, it perhaps has made a normal situation stranger than it should be.
That could be it, you know, honestly. I think there are several possibilities. You know, like it could just be that there wasn't much traffic that day. And then, you know, of course, if you want to get weird with it, which we do, it could be that somehow they were isolated in space time in this sort of like pocket dimension where they're still able to perceive like this reality but aren't actually a part of it. Or it could be that this creature was somehow blocking their perception of traffic. So the cars were there, but they just couldn't see them or experience them, you know, or maybe even it's that they were so locked in on this thing because it was so strange that there were cars there, but they just didn't notice them because they were so hyper-focused on this weird creature that then when they go and think about it later, they're like, oh, it's so weird there weren't any cars there. But really, they just didn't notice them because there's a monster nearby that they're giving most of their attention to.
Whatever the explanation is, I think regardless, we've still got this strange pixelated creature that's causing the main problem here. And I don't think we need to lose focus of the strange encounter that they've had regardless.
No, absolutely. I do love to digress. So I apologize, but you're absolutely right. What's interesting too about this is after this particular encounter came out, I received another one from a gentleman sort of near that same area, like maybe 5 miles away. Mm. And this guy said that he was out with his wife driving this sort of, would have been a couple of years ago, August 2019. And this was later, like this was like 11 p.m. And he said that they spotted this thing in the road. And at first assumed it was some sort of normal animal. But then he saw that it didn't fit the description of really anything that he'd ever seen before. You know, he describes it as having sort of a rounded head and a flat face with no snout or muzzle. Couldn't see any ears, or, you know, at the very least, they were very tight against the animal's head, and that it was dark brown with a long, slim tail that curled under it as it was crossing the road. And now, to me, hearing that description, I don't know that it's actually related to the other sighting, because that sounds potentially like somebody who just saw a mountain lion, you know, moving very quickly across the road and didn't get a good look at it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't know that it's necessarily related. But interestingly, he shared this article from earlier that year, it was the month before, in which this guy reported a mountain lion in that same area. He said that he had seen this you know, large cat resting underneath a bridge nearby. And he said, you know, like he'd seen it kind of moving and was frightened because mountain lions honestly are pretty scary. And he got out of there. And he went and got the police, and they investigated and everything. So, you know, there had been at least one mountain lion sighting in that area prior to this guy's sighting. And so I think that some people will look at this going back to the Beloit sighting with the pixelated animal or being or whatever it was. And it could be tempting to say, you know, that it's a misidentified mountain lion or like a mountain lion or something that they just weren't used to seeing. But I think that unfortunately what that represents more than anything is a lot of people's predilection for really just doing anything they can to force out elements of high strangeness. So, I mean, just because we've got potentially other mountain lion sightings in that area doesn't mean that has to be what this woman and her husband saw, right?
Yeah.
You know, because the idea that their reaction to seeing a mountain lion, which frankly, like they're rare, but they're not unheard of here, you know, like they're really not. The idea that their reaction to seeing a mountain lion would be to completely lose all grasp of reality and start seeing it as this pixelated, seemingly intelligent being. I mean, that's as ludicrous to me as I think probably the idea of a firm materialist entertaining like the high strangeness aspects of encounter like this. And I just think it's important for people to sort of keep things in perspective, you know, and because it's important to try to explain the things that we can. If we have good evidence that points towards a prosaic explanation, then I think it would be dishonest to ignore that. And sort of my approach has always been, you know, to be very open and honest about that kind of thing. Because, you know, frankly, if, you know, I'm not telling people about the sightings that likely could have prosaic explanations, why would they ever believe me about the ones that don't? You know, I mean, like how could you trust somebody to be able to tell the difference between a sighting that has a potentially mundane explanation to it and one that doesn't, if they never have any cases that they're able to solve through these prosaic explanations? And say, okay, well, everybody needs to examine their bias when they're looking at this case, because if you are accepting that the witness is authentically relating her experience to you, and frankly, we have no evidence that she isn't, then you can't use any nearby mountain lion sightings as an explanation for her experience, because her experience isn't what a mountain lion sighting is, frankly. Like that's not what you would expect if that's what she had seen.
And also, one would hope that the husband would know what a mountain lion looked like, Tobias, and for him to for that explanation to be put forward to explain her witness report completely ignores the fact that the husband is adamant that it was a weird dog. You know, with the greatest respect, there's very few breeds of dog, in fact I can think of two or three at most, that you could possibly mistake for any type of mountain lion at all. And they're probably rarer than a mountain lion in the States, I would suspect.
Oh, definitely. There's nothing about that explanation would make sense. It's just something I think is very much worth mentioning. Well, the other thing that's interesting too is in that latter case where the gentleman shared that news article with me, and going through the news article itself, interestingly, the guy interviewed, you know, for that news article, who had supposedly seen the mountain lion, he never calls it a mountain lion ever. He just refers to it as an animal, some kind of animal. And then people just sort of assumed that it was a mountain lion, you know, partially based on his description, but also due to their own bias, you know, rather than saying, okay, well, this guy saw an unexplained animal, we don't know what it is, people's need to have to explain it as something filled in the gaps. And they were like, oh, he must have seen a mountain lion. And I think that's something that we in the paranormal need to struggle against constantly. And that is explaining things that we don't have explanations for. And I see it a lot, and I see it from every side. You know, I will see people call something a hoax, for instance, when they don't have any evidence, zero evidence that it is a hoax. What they often have is a lack of evidence to satisfy them in terms of believing this actual report, which is fine. You don't have to believe it. But what they can't then say is that because the evidence has not satisfied them, it must be a hoax. And yet we see it all the time, and it's very disappointing. And of course, you know, you see all manner of credulous folks who might believe things without evidence or overlay like their own personal bias onto a report to explain something as, you know, like, oh, well, you saw insert name of their favorite cryptid here. Whether or not they know that that person actually saw that or not, they try to explain it as their preferred explanation rather than just being able to sit quietly with the fact that it's unexplained. And that's something I just feel very strongly to be better at. Sometimes we just don't know what someone experienced, and we have to be okay with it. If we want to present a range of possibilities that in our belief are some things have experienced, I think that's fair enough. But we also have to be willing to say, I don't know. I don't know what these people experience in this particular case with the pixelated chimeric entity. I don't know what they saw. I have no idea. And that's okay. It has to be okay, because what other choice do we have?
Yes, I'm a big fan of saying I don't know. If because often that's the easiest thing to do, Tobias. And I think often, as you say there, people are so determined to explain it, whether they are a believer or a skeptic, regardless, people are very quick to try and say it's this, this, or this. I'm often reminded of a paranormal event I once saw on a documentary, and a very famous skeptic couldn't explain how it happened, and then decided to say, well, if I was going to fake it, this is what I try to do. And the person they were explaining it to just looked absolutely nonplussed as this person sort of spread themselves out like some kind of human crab, trying to explain how this person could have possibly been fooled. And they seemed even less convinced by this skeptical explanation to the weirdness they'd witnessed. So it is frustrating. I completely agree with you that regardless, I think sometimes we just have to hold our hands up and say, I've no idea what the hell's gone on there.
Yeah, no, I find myself in that position much of the time. So, yes.
Well, I think the last witness I'd like to touch on before I release you back to the wilds of Wisconsin, my friend, is one of those aspects that there is a bit of reality in regards to this kind of situation, where I think most of us have had a situation in our lives where we think that we are somewhere we know fairly well, and then it's as if everything's changed and we feel lost. And it's feeling lost, especially as an adult, Tobias, I think is quite a frightening emotion to feel. You feel completely out of control. It's not an emotion adults tend to be very comfortable with. Children, we can expect it with. But I think when an adult feels the realization that they've no idea where they are, despite the fact they think they know where they are, it can be quite scary. And this is a very odd situation featuring a lady called Shirley, who's gone for a lovely sort of picnic with her family in the wonderful Okefenokee Swamp area, which is known for being a very strange place. And some people say, well, getting lost doesn't sound that particularly scary. But this is a very odd aspect of this, because everything seems fine until they decide to set off for their picnic.
Yeah, this is one where it's difficult to sort of classify it. You know, I ended up including it in the chapter with sort of high strangeness window areas, you know, based largely on its having occurred in the Okefenokee Swamp, which I've come to find out is sort of known for a number of different seemingly paranormal phenomena that people have reported there. And so this particular woman, this would have been over 20 years ago. This happened in 2000. She was on vacation with her family, and they had decided to stop at this recreational area in the Okefenokee Swamp, because it's also like a national park. You can go visit it and enjoy nature. Mm-hmm. So they're at the Suwannee Canal Recreation Area, and they rent a motorboat, and they go up the canal to this picnic area, which is on this sort of meandering canal, as Shirley described it. And so conditions were what she also described as low and trashy. So there's really no way of getting lost. And I assume that trashy is some kind of nautical term that I don't really know. Because it seemed very like official in the way that she used it, but who knows? Anyway, so there really wasn't much chance of them getting lost. And the canal it's open and easy to follow. And so they get to this picnic area, which is on what's known as trembling earth. And so like what you find a lot in these swamps is plant and vegetable matter that form almost like these floating islands kind of, and they're solid enough where you can get on them and walk around and such. And so, and that's what they did. And it was, you know, a nice little picnic, and they decide that they're going to head back. And as they're getting ready to leave, they're approached by two young men in another motorboat, and they were sort of visibly distressed, and they asked Shirley and her family if they could follow them back to the concession area, like the boat rental area and everything, because they said that they had just tried and they couldn't get through, which obviously immediately seemed weird to Shirley. And so she thought, okay, well, these guys just got lost. It happens. Sure. You know, you can follow us. She said they did not appear to be drunk or anything. Mm. And so they head out, and, you know, after only about 30 feet, they see this strip of dry land with tall grass growing on it. And, you know, they thought about just portaging over it, decided it probably wasn't a great idea, because, you know, they're in this wild swamp they're not really familiar with. And she said she even, like, got the boat up next to it and touched it, and it felt really solid. So not necessarily something you would expect out of, like, you know, any kind of, like, vegetable mass that would just be floating around out there. Mm. And so, you know, at this point, they are stymied, and they go back to the picnic area so they can start over to see if they took a wrong turn or something, determined that they hadn't. And on the way back, she said that they, and this is one of the weirdest parts, that they had passed this elderly couple paddling their canoe in the direction of the barrier. And she calls out to them to try to warn them that there's something blocking the way up ahead. And she said that they didn't even look at her. Like, they just kept their focus straight ahead and didn't acknowledge her presence at all. So either somehow they weren't able to perceive her, or they're just very, very rude. I don't know, but they didn't acknowledge her at all. And so they make it back to the picnic area, decide to try again. And this time they went the exact same way, and there weren't any barriers. Like, this thing, this landmass, whatever they had run into, just wasn't there anymore. And she couldn't explain it. She said these two young men that had followed them, like, once they got back, they just left immediately. They didn't want to talk about it. They seemed, you know, visibly disturbed, and that was it. They just left immediately, got in their car, and took off. And I mean, that's basically her story. You know, I couldn't make much sense of it based on any, you know, potentially mundane explanation that I could think of, because, again, like, how I like to approach these experiences when they're related to me is I always proceed as though what the witness is telling me is accurate to their experience, in unless I have evidence otherwise. And so there's nothing I could find to really explain Shirley's experience here. Now, you know, there are things like tussocks and floating islands and things that, you know, can be found in swamps, but they don't really describe what the way that they surely describe this landmass doesn't really fit with anything like a tussock or floating island or anything similar. I mean, you know, like, she was able to approach this thing. It was dry. It didn't seem to be made out of, you know, like, the peat and mud and stuff that you would expect from something like a floating island or a tussock or anything like that. It very much seemed like dry land up above the water, coming out of the water, that just shouldn't have been there. you know, and then when they went back, it wasn't. If it was something that, you know, like a floating island or something, you would expect to at least have been able to find it again, because they really just went back to this other, like, trembling earth island and used it as a point of reference to start out on their journey again. So the whole thing is just very strange, honestly, and there's no good explanation for it. One other thing that stuck out, though, and I like to mention this because it's pretty annoying, honestly, is, you know, she got back to this boat launch and the concession area, and she was sort of describing that, you know, they had experienced all that. The person working the concession stand just had to. Did you know that there's old Indian burial ground in this area? As though that would have anything to do with anything. It's one of the most common and most infuriating explanations for anything weird that you'll encounter in this field is that, oh, it's an old Native American burial ground. Of course it is. Now, there are actually some mounds in that area, and they're very, very interesting culturally and historically. But the idea that they would have anything to do with something like this is maddening. You know, because again, you see it so often. One, I don't know why anybody thinks that any indigenous burial mound is likelier to be haunted than, say, a colonial cemetery or something, which in my opinion, cemeteries are not often haunted. And if they are, I think it's more of a emotional sort of residue rather than what, you know, people would consider a traditional haunting. But, you know, it really just sort of speaks to, like, the othering of indigenous people in this country, that, you know, you have to ascribe magical phenomena to, or like otherworldly phenomena or the paranormal specifically to, you know, indigenous burial mounds. And you see it too often. And I'm at the point now where every time I hear it, I have to tell people why that doesn't make sense and we shouldn't do it. There's nothing paranormal about, like, indigenous burial mounds. They have a vast cultural and historical relevance, and we should be interested in them for that. But sort of the idea of the magical Indian burial ground should just go away, right? You know. I guess that's about all I have to say about that. But it was something that stuck out to me in this particular story, to the point where, like, I went in the book and I wanted to devote at least a couple paragraphs into the actual history of burial mounds in that area. And then, you know, why it doesn't really make much sense for people to attribute, you know, anything people experience that's unusual in that area to the actual mounds themselves. It's the whole thing. It's a little racist, not going to lie. And I really wish people would stop doing it.
Yeah, it's a paranormal cliche, Tobias.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm with you. It's maddening. It's one of those things. It's like the old, or this house is haunted because somebody killed themselves, or it's always a heartbroken woman who's thrown herself, who thinks so less of herself, Tobias, that she's had to kill herself because her life can't go on without this horrible man in it. And it's just one of those cliches that we all deal with. So fair play to you. I completely agree. I mean, Strange Tales of the Impossible is a fabulous collection of weird and wonderful encounters and case files from the Singular Fortean Society. So I heartily recommend it. It's a book that makes you scratch your head and stroke your chin and wonder, as we've touched on in a couple of these cases, what the hell these people have seen and witnessed and gone through. It's a great addition to anybody's Fortean library, and I commend you on it. It's a really, really interesting selection of stories. So thank you for taking me through some of these cases.
Well, honestly, thank you so much for having me. I do enjoy getting to talk about this stuff. And as we did note earlier, I don't get enough of a chance to talk about it in, you know, just in normal day-to-day life. So I'm happy to be here.
Oh, you're very welcome. So, Tobias, where can everybody keep up to date with the Singular 14 Society and get a hold of a copy of this wonderful collection of curious cases?
Sure. So if you're interested in what we do at the Singular 14 Society, you can, of course, visit our website at singular14.com. There is a link there where you can buy both of the books that we have out now. You can buy them signed through the website. Otherwise, they're also available at, you know, major book retailers like Amazon, for instance. And we do have links to all of that on the website. You can also follow us on social media. So Singular 14 Society is on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Tumblr, you know, all of the normal social medias that a 40-plus-year-old man is aware of. and if you like what we do enough that you want to be a part of it, please visit our Patreon.
Excellent. I shall put links to everything. One last thing before I let you leave. I would like to congratulate Emily on a couple of wonderful covers that she's done for the Feminine Macabre series in the last few months as well. So that's a fabulous collection, and Emily has a real eye for spooky creations as well, Tobias.
Oh, you are absolutely correct. She does absolutely a beautiful work, frankly. She did both of the covers for the books that we put out through the Singular 14 Society, of course. And, you know, she's working on the cover for the third Feminine Macabre volume now. She actually has an article which I recommend to anyone. It's a fascinating creation of a potentially paranormal photograph that she had found. So, you know, for anybody who doesn't know, Emily has a degree in photography, and she does all of the photographic and a video examination for us here at the Singular 14 Society. I've learned a lot from her, you know, in terms of how to pick apart a photograph and examine all of the different elements of it and sort of come up with any potential prosaic explanations. So, but yeah, she does absolutely beautiful work because she also has a degree in design. And so, yeah, she's done all of the covers for the Feminine Macabre, and she also recently did a book cover for One Bed Over, which is an exploration of hauntings in hospital settings, which is another book that people might want to check out if they're interested in the unusual.
Fantastic. Well, I'll make sure I put a link to the volume of Feminine Macabre where Emily's article is included as well for you both. And I just want to say thank you again, Tobias. It's been too long, my friend, and I'm delighted to have spent a bit of time in your company going through this fabulous book, and I wish you all the very best, and hopefully we will speak soon.
Oh, definitely. It's always a pleasure, Paul.